Okay, this is Jane Poulin with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission interviewing James Tisch. And Jim, may I call you Jim?
Absolutely.
Okay. Jim, you're familiar with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, I think, and realize that we're congressionally mandated or congressionally formed and mandated to investigate causes of the financial crisis.
Right.
And we reached out to you so that we could get your views on kind of the role of accounting and any topics in that realm during the financial crisis. I've read some of the public statements that you've made, so I have a little bit of background on perhaps what your views are, but want to make sure that we have all of your views in our purview as we move forward.
Okay.
So with that, I kind of can throw it open to you, and you can give me your views on any topics that come to mind, and then if I have topics kind of on my list of things that I've heard either from other people or we had observations ourselves, I may pulse you on those as well to see if you have any views.
Okay. First things first, as I said to you before the tape recorder started going, I'm happy for you to share this tape with anybody at the commission. But I'd prefer that it not be publicly released or anything be printed with my name without my prior consent.
Okay.
When I heard you were going to call me, my expectation was that you wanted to discuss accounting going forward. I'm happy to account it, to talk about it in retrospect. But at some point, I'd also like to talk about what the FASB is planning for this summer and fall in terms of mark-to-market accounting.
Okay, I would love to get both of those.
Okay, so
before you just jump into that, can you just give me a little brief what your background is. I'm sure most people are familiar with it, but in case others are listening.
I am the CEO of Lowe's Corporation, the New York Stock Exchange listed company with a market value of about $13 or $14 billion. We have five different subsidiaries. Three of them are public. The three public subsidiaries are a commercial property casualty insurance company called CNA Financial, which is based in Chicago. We own 90% of that. We own just over 50% of Diamond Offshore Drilling, which is a offshore drilling contractor based in Houston. And we own the general partnership and about two-thirds of the limited partnership interest in an enterprise called Boardwalk Pipeline Partners, which is a natural gas interstate pipeline. We also have two wholly owned subsidiaries. One is High Mount Exploration and Production, which is in the gas exploration and production business. And we also have Lowe's Hotels, which is based here in New York, that has a chain of 18 or 19 hotels around the United States and Canada. So let me talk prospectively, and then from that we can also go back and look what happened over the past several years. First of all, let me say I am different than most S&P 500 CEOs because we are a conglomerate, we're a multi-industry company, and I don't manage any one specific business. We have CEOs that manage each of our five businesses, and they focus on the day-to-day and week-to-week management of the business. And we have a small staff at the holding company at Lowe's, and we get involved to the subsidiaries in terms of setting long-term strategic policy, financial policies, and investing the assets of the subsidiaries. So we cover a lot of territory at Lowe's. CNA is a financial company. It's got about $40 billion of investment assets. And it's in, as I said, it's in the commercial property casualty industry. So mark-to-market accounting is a topic that I'm very familiar with in dealing with CNA. At our other subsidiaries, we don't really have the same. The accounting issues are not of as nearly as much importance as they are for CNA and our commercial property casualty insurance company. It is an annoyance when it comes to our gas exploration and production company, but that relates to the SEC rules concerning when you have to take write-downs on gas assets.
Right.
And there the problem, I think, has been corrected. Prior to this year, you had to write down your SEC 10 values on the basis of a gas price on one specific day. And so it was really a draconian test that led to a lot of companies writing down their gas assets because at the end of one quarter, gas prices were abnormally low. But the real issue for us and also for the whole economy in 07 and 08 was this issue of mark-to-market accounting. Going forward, the FASB is about to come out with an exposure draft that will mandate mark-to-market accounting for all financial institutions. And from my perspective, it is a crazy, ridiculous proposal that I think they're going to issue that can actually do significant damage to the economy. And feel free to barge in with a question.
I was just pulling up the FASB website. I think they actually issued the ED yesterday.
They issued the exposure draft yesterday?
I thought I had a clip on it, but anyway, it's supposed to be imminent if it hasn't been issued already.
Okay. In my mind, if it contains what I think it's going to contain, it's crazy, and it will be injurious to the economy. First of all, for our insurance company, it won't be injurious to the economy, but it will be a major annoyance. We have a $40 billion investment portfolio. We make about $750 million to $1 billion a year under traditional accounting. What they want us to do in this new proposal is to include in our income every quarter the change in market value of our portfolio. And so for 08, if that system had been in place, instead of making about $1 billion, we would have lost about $4 billion because we had a $5 billion swing in our portfolio. That was a mark-to-market swing. In 09, instead of earning $750 million or whatever CNA earned, we would have reported earnings of $5.5 billion because the portfolio had completely come back.
Right.
When people, I believe that the financial statements should generally follow the way that management looks at their business. And when the management of our insurance company looks at it, we don't think of the change in the market value of the security as a prime factor in our profitability. We have reserves of about $35 billion, and those reserves on the liability side are represented on the asset side by the investment assets. And those reserves are, there cannot be a run on the bank for our insurance company. We do not have depositors. We pay out claims. And we know, because we're large enough and have enough experience, about over what period those claims are going to be paid out. So that for much of our portfolio, which is pure property casualty insurance claims, they have a duration of about 4 years. And for some of our runoff life insurance portfolios, those have a duration of about 10 or 12 years. So we match the portfolio duration to the duration of the liabilities. And so we're pretty much matched.
Mm-hmm.
So that if we have to go to mark-to-market accounting and recognize the unrealized gain and loss in the income statement every quarter and every year, number one, it will not reflect the way we look at the business. Number two, it would drive us to not match our assets to our liability, because we'll want to avoid a big loss. So we would shorten our portfolio. That would hurt our profitability, and it would all be in the name of some guys sitting up in Norwalk trying to achieve some hypothetical nirvana in terms of the purity of financial statements.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk to Wall Street analysts, the first thing that they would tell you is that if we have to mark our portfolio to market every quarter and take it through the income statement, the first thing that they would do when we report earnings is to either add back the loss or deduct the gain, the mark-to-market gain, from the net income that we reported.
Can I just stop you right there, because that's an interesting point, and I just want to get your opinion on this. So, and you're really talking about your insurance business, so I'm interested in particular your view on the insurance industry versus others.
I'll also get to the banks in just a minute. But go ahead, ask.
Well, I'm just curious whether you have any idea whether analysts view, say, financial institutions and non-financial institutions differently in terms of whether they think fair value accounting is how they want to look at the financial statements. And then, so for the insurance company, it seems though you're telling me the analysts are saying they don't want the financial statements at fair value.
The answer is they've already got all the information there. So it's just a matter of geography of the financial statements and what is presented where.
Right. The other thing is, I just want to make sure you're aware that there's also a financial statement presentations exposure draft, I think, that's supposed to come out, which will be a standard, or it's already out, and there will be a standard that will be effective relatively soon, perhaps before the time that the financial asset measurement standard that you refer to becomes effective. And that, if you haven't looked at that, you may want to look at that, because that's going to change how we look at earnings. So instead of having an income statement and a separate comprehensive income presentation that sometimes is in a footnote, it'll be required to all be on one statement. So that things that are affecting comprehensive income will all be on that performance, if you will, performance statement. So things that previously would have thought don't affect income because they're in comprehensive income, like available for sale securities that are marked to market, will now show up in this replacement of the income statement, but it'll be in the category of unrealized. And then you have this recycling mechanism, so when things move from unrealized to realized, they'll show up in two different places on this earnings statement.
Well, I have a theory about what's going on. My general view is that people on Wall Street really don't want what the FASB is offering up. They tend to view it as not reflecting reality and not a good measure of corporate income.
And is that just on the fair value point or more broadly?
That's on the fair value point.
Okay.
And I think what's happened is that the people that are talking to the FASB are not the people on Wall Street. For whatever reasons, the FASB hasn't really gotten good, significant input from Wall Street on their view of what numbers they want to see reported as net income.
And can I pulse you a little bit on that, too? Because in circles of people that I talk to on this topic, both here at the FCIC and for years prior as well and outside of my life here, the concept of the FASB getting user input into their standard-setting process is a question I like to pulse people on. So the FASB, they expose their products, they request comments on the materials that they produce. They have what they believe are user representatives who sit on the board and other working groups. So I'm curious if you have an idea how the FASB would go about getting the view of Wall Street, because I think if you asked the FASB if they got user input, they would think that they do, and they've actually taken more extensive efforts to try to get that view in recent years than they did historically.
So we took a drive up to Norwalk about 3 months ago to talk to them about this. And they number one, they were very appreciative that we came up. I went up with my CFO. Uh-huh. And also the CFO from our insurance company. And we actually had a productive conversation. What was so extraordinary to me is that they said that they really hadn't heard before what we were saying to them, and they didn't fully comprehend and understand all the issues that this was going to create. And as we were driving back, I said to the two CEOs that I was with, what's up with this? Are these guys just totally isolated? And the response was that the way they get input is through hearings. They don't, they're up in Norwalk, as you heard, people that have to use these rules don't go up and see them. They have a hearing. They don't have a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And so while they may be hearing from a lot of people, they're not getting, they're not having a dialogue with them, and they're not fully understanding the impact of their numbers,
okay.
of their rules.
They need to have more, I guess, direct interaction with people that are actually real live users, analysts. And I was trying to get more specific because, for example, I know they often get a comment letter from the CFA Institute. And
yeah, but I got to tell you something. The CFA Institute, they are not real practitioners. I know. What's his first name? Shaq. who's at the CFA Institute. One second, I'm sorry. They are. I had lunch with them and just. Kurt Schack. I had lunch with him and discussed this. And in fact, he brought another guy, and they were both strong mark-to-market. Adherence. I would call them more gadflies than anything else. Kurt is the managing director of the CFA Institute. They don't manage money. What they are is an accreditation organization, and so they're not. They don't represent corporate management. They don't represent really Wall Street analysts.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage the FASB to call up Wall Street analysts and hear what they have to say, and to call up the managements of businesses and hear what they have to say. And they just don't do it. And I think that analysts and management of companies have decided that they're not going to wade into this swamp. They'll just deal with whatever rules there are.
Yeah, well, in some regards, having been in a company and in a role where you're just you have other things to do than read the draft standards and write comment letters. So you already have a full-time job, and you don't have the resources to devote to having a full-time person that just oversees standard setting and develops a view for the corporation. So there's that issue as well. But I'm happy to have your input on CFA, but let me just press a little bit more just so that I better understand.
Yeah.
Because CFA Institute, do most analysts who are on Wall Street, are they members? Or not?
The CFA is an accrediting organization.
Okay.
And so
analysts are members, but the people that are writing the letters on behalf of CFA Institute aren't actually the members.
Man, I don't know who's writing the letters on behalf. But, I mean, to me, they have all the hallmarks of gadflies because they focus on this stuff. They pay a lot of attention. But they don't have a lot of skin in the game, as best I can tell.
Okay.
So but they are true believers in this.
Of fair value, yeah.
Yes.
So the FASB, if you had your choice, would have a revision to their methodology on how they get user input. But you also mentioned corporate management, which this is another area that I have interest in and have pulsed people on over the years, which is there a difference between users and preparers? Because the FASB is very interested in getting user input, but having been a preparer and understand what preparers have to go through with the complexities of organizations, the additional requirement for extensive disclosure, and accelerated timelines upon which filings have to be made and earnings are released, depending on what industry you're in. Preparers have their own beef with what the FASB does as well.
All I can say to that is amen.
Oh, okay.
amen 100 times over.
So the FASB should get more real user input and more real preparer input.
We spend an enormous amount on following these rules and regulations, and it is literally a nightmare. Right now, we use available for sale accounting for most of our investment portfolio,
mm-hmm.
and Last year, the FASB made a change in available for sale so that, let me see if I can get this right.
The impairment model change?
Yes. You didn't, in terms, they changed from an intent to, an assertion of an intent to hold to instead making an assertion of intent to sell. And the work that was required in the second quarter in terms of implementing that was extraordinary. And for what purpose? And the FASB has just no understanding of how much work is involved or seem to pay no lip service to a cost benefit analysis of the rules that they put in place.
I'm not challenging you, but I think if you asked them, they would say they did do a cost benefit analysis. So,
my guess is they're not talking to our CFO.
So perhaps they need to get different, better data.
Yeah.
More robust.
I'll tell you one other thing that's going on that is a dynamic that we're not really talking about, but as long as I'm venting on accounting, I'll talk to you about it. And that is there's a dynamic going on between the accounting firms and the PCAOB that is really a problem.
Explain that to me.
So the dynamic is that the last thing that the accounting firm wants to do is to have been cited more than other accounting firms in these PCAOB inspections.
Right.
And so what that does is it filters down to us, the registrant, because it's much, much, much more difficult getting accounting firm sign-off because the accountants are afraid that every I will not be dotted and every T crossed, and their work papers need enough for that PCAOB inspection that comes.
Ah. And did your memory get jogged on this topic because we were talking about costs?
Yes.
Yeah. So
again,
all of that time that's spent by the audit firm to meet that challenge, which is to not be cited by the PCAOB as having deficiencies greater than their peer group, means that the time that the audit staff uses to nail things down translates
exactly
into you paying a bigger audit fee.
Yeah, and I can put you in touch with our CFO, who can give you chapter and verse on it. So we just had to deal with it this year. Deloitte and Touche is our accountant, and they got cited. Their audit of us, I think from last year, was one of the items that PCAOB audited the audit.
Right.
And they came up with, I don't know how many things, but it was just a total embarrassment to, not embarrassment to the accounting firm. The accounting firm, Deloitte & Touche, did totally buy their work, but for them it was a big black eye that this whole thing happened. But I don't know that there was no bad accounting in there. It was just that the work papers weren't clean enough.
There's a lot of issues with documentation.
Yeah,
so.
We the filer have to suffer while the accounting firm gets all those files together.
Right.
So it adds up to dramatically increased costs.
Yeah, and I hear the something along the lines of what you said, that it's difficult to get accounting issues nailed down from multiple different sources. I've talked to, you know, companies through job search process, and they lament about how anything that's remotely technical, it has to go to the national offices.
National office.
And it takes forever.
That's right.
And then the client sitting there feeling like, I don't understand what the audit and engagement partner, it's almost like the role of the audit and engagement partner is confusing, because
yes,
now that person can't make calls that in previous years clients would have expected them to be able to make calls on. Which leads us right back to the FASB again, perhaps, because of complexity in the accounting.
As I said, for us, it's an annoyance. For the banks, it's going to be life and death. And the reason is that these geniuses in Norwalk have decided that the banks should no longer have loan loss reserves, but rather they should mark their loans to market every quarter. So I guess the anticipation is that they will think of loans as level 3 type securities, and they'll just have to market to market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is going to be disaster for the economy, because it will make bank lending entirely pro-cyclical, such that when things are good, they will be the banks will be manic and able to lend out more, because they're going to have more capital, because the mark-to-market on their loans will be higher.
Right.
And then when things are bad, as they were in late 08 and 09, they will be totally depressing the economy, because their mark-to-markets on their loan portfolio will be much lower, and their capital will be constrained as a result. And so if this system goes into place without regulators putting in an alternative system, it will create an environment that banks will not be willing to make nearly as many loans for fear that the price of those loans, the mark-to-market value of those loans, will go down, and they won't then have enough capital. So it is crazy. The notion that these loans should be mark-to-market is taking a desire for sacrificing the good the name of achieving the perfect theoretical value.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sit on the board of the New York Fed. I've spoken to Bill Dudley, who's the chairman, who thinks that this is lunacy. I have spoken, I was at a lunch with Ben Bernanke, who thinks this is craziness, and their problem is that they've got so many other issues that they're dealing with that they just feel they can't spend the time on this issue, but it's one that is of great concern to them.
For banking institutions.
Well, concern on the part of the Fed,
right,
thinking that this is not the way, as their regulator, this is not the way they want them to do their accounting, but also understanding that they may not have much say in this, because they feel they don't have the political capital to spend in pursuing this issue.
Right. Yeah, the alternatives would be to try to convince FASB to do something different, or change the regulatory gap, which I don't think anybody really has the will to go there. I haven't heard that anyone has had the will.
I think if the FASB comes out with it, they will have to. They'll have to put in place a statutory accounting system similar to what we have in insurance. In insurance, we report GAAP, and then we also have to file statutory statements.
Right, yes. It's been a long time, but I was on an insurance company way back when, my audit.
Okay.
But I had forgotten, yes, because there's so many different regulatory regime. Everybody has a different view of how they look at companies.
Right.
Okay, so then I don't want to cut you off. Was there any? So during the crisis, you believe that mark-to-market accounting was an issue for your company, and then also you said I think for the marketplace.
You know, for our company, it was more of a curiosity than life or death. Mm-hmm. People generally understood what was going on. If you read the transcripts of our earnings conference calls in the last two conference calls, I've spoken about mark-to-market accounting, and I have warned. My view is, I want to put the marker down. Here's my concern: that when, as and if, interest rates go back up, we will have, and I believe they will go back up significantly, we will have a significant mark-to-market loss in our portfolio. And as a result of that mark-to-market loss, we will have reduced book value, because the shareholders' equity reflects the unrealized gain or loss in the portfolio.
Right. Even under current accounting, because you've got everything
under
available for sale.
It's just that under current accounting, it doesn't pass through the income statement, except for trading securities. Which we don't have too much of, but it does, but not available for sale or hold to maturity securities. So I am, for the past two quarters, I have been warning investors that there is the potential for our book value to decline, and I make the point that it is entirely cosmetic, that the portfolios are matched, and that while the assets are mark-to-market, the liabilities are not.
Mm-hmm.
And I also make the point that we're not a bank and that we can't have a run on the bank because we don't have deposits, we have reserves.
Right.
I say all this because I want to make the point to the shareholders and to investors, in a time when things are calm and quiet, so that when we get to that future point in time when they're not so calm, not so quiet, and when the book value has gone down significantly, I can actually point to the calls and say, listen, this is nothing different than we were expecting.
Right.
And pay it no never mind.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, for us, it's not life or death. It's more cosmetics. Mm-hmm. For the banks, it will be life or death.
So I understand your view on the FASB model prospectively and mark-to-market of loans, but if we look back during the crisis, I just want to talk through the mark-to-market's role during the crisis for financial institutions. So here's some of the things that I've considered. So mark-to-market accounting is going to show up on the bank's financial statements, which come out every 90 days. And when they do come out, they're dated, right? They're 30, 60, 90 days old. So some people have argued that mark-to-market accounting caused pro-cyclicality of the values of securities. So I look at when the financial statements come out, the timing, right, and the staleness of them when they come out, and I wonder, is it really the number that's on the financial statements that's driving trades? Don't the people that are trading the securities, that are on a bank's balance sheet, don't they have information well in advance of these financial statements that would be more relevant to their day-to-day, do I buy, sell, and at what price? But then I'm curious, you know, what's your view on that? Do you think that the fair value numbers that show up on the public filings are, how is that affecting the market? Or is there more to it? Is it that you think that, or you know from your conversations, that banks were seeing trades going on and knowing that at the next quarter end they would produce financial statements, they'd have the mark-to-market on those financial statements, it would show less net assets and therefore less capital. And then they were anticipating that and were de-levering.
I think they were de-levering.
Okay, so
I can tell you, for us, we do not have a lot of level 3 assets. But we didn't, there was such enormous volatility in the second half of 08 and in 09 that we did not know within, say, $300 or $400 million, what our mark-to-market hit was going to be at the end of the quarter. And we didn't know for about 2 weeks or so, 2 or 3 weeks. It took that long to go through the process and get the numbers in, and only then, after 2 or 3 weeks, did we have a rough idea, and then it would come together in the last 10 days or so. So it was that. There was also, at the time, the whole impairment process, where you had to take impairments to market value on securities where you thought there was a potential that there could be some loss of principal. And the markets were so out of whack that a security where you thought you were going to get, instead of getting par back, you would get, at the worst, 97,
mm-hmm.
you might have had to mark that thing at 30 cents on the dollar because that was, quote, the market for those securities at that point in time.
Right, so some of the decline that was being experienced in the market was more due to liquidity than credit.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is why the FASB ultimately changed the impairment model for held-to-maturity securities in response to that phenomenon.
Not for available-for-sale securities.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It might have been good if the FASB had done what they did to the impairment model earlier on. The fact that it came at the time that it did,
right,
kind of late in the crisis, and immediate kind of turnaround, like you talked about before, very problematic for
repairs. Yeah, and as a result of the accounting rules, I strongly believe, I saw this for ourselves, I strongly believe that financial institutions did not feel comfortable buying those securities because they couldn't afford to take the hit to capital just in the next quarter if those securities continued going down.
So that was part of the freeze-up, is they were afraid to buy because they might have to mark, they'd have to mark them.
Yes.
And that would, yeah, so they'd use up more of their capital than they were originally anticipating.
Exactly.
Yeah, by making the acquisition. Got it. Okay.
The accounting was pure, as they say, white water at the time. You were bailing out constantly. You had no idea till at least a few weeks after the quarter ended what your actual mark to market was. And so you were going not so much by the numbers as by gut feel.
Right. So if you don't know what the mark-to-market's going to be and you have any kind of concern about either market perception or actual, you know, the number that's produced and how far you are away from required minimum capital, you might sell more to be on the safe side.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So if I don't know what my mark's going to be, and for, in your case, you're dealing with $300 to $400 million range, some of these big financial institutions may have had a bigger, you know, unknown, can't forecast it, so therefore I don't know where I'm going to be on my mark-to-market charge, so I don't know where my capital's going to be. Boy, I should sell some more of my assets so I have a cushion.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And, I mean, I distinctly remember that we thought that there were phenomenal values. We thought there were phenomenal values at the time, only we couldn't take advantage of it because of the mark-to-market accounting.
Ah, so that answers, because some people would say, well, geez, if everybody thought that the values were so wrong and so low, why weren't they buying? So that answers the question, why weren't they buying? They didn't have they didn't have room, and they did. They at some point that people felt like, well, even if it's low, it may go lower next quarter, so I'm going to use up more of my capital.
Okay.
Yeah, I see. Okay, it's very helpful, helping me piece together the. It's more than just mark-to-market accounting. There's a story to it, how it impacts decision making.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I was on a. I remember I was on a panel at the SEC, I think it was in the first half of 08, on mark-to-market accounting.
Oh, one of the round table, like a round table?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I remember I was sitting next to the guy from Goldman Sachs whose view was everything should be mark-to-market.
Now, that's kind of an investment bank view from what I understand. Investment bankers...
Right.
Want everything marked to market. They run a matchbook. Yeah.
Exactly right. And they don't understand. He could not understand that for those of us that have term liabilities, that mark to market just is not the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you
can't run a life insurance company if your capital is going to be determined based on mark-to-market, because the nature of your liabilities is long-term.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I've talked to some people that take even the extreme view and say everything should be mark-to-market, the entire balance sheet, assets, liabilities.
Well, and in fact, somebody who works here made the point that if banks have to mark their loans to market, then why don't other institutions have to mark their factories and all their other assets to market? I mean, that's how crazy it is. Who knows what a loan is worth?
Well, that's why I asked whether you thought analysts have a different view. If it's a brick-and-mortar company, my speculation is that if it's a brick-and-mortar company, they don't want any. They think that fair value stuff coming through the P&L is just noise. They don't want any unrealized gains and losses in the P&L, and they don't want. They want to know the performance that comes from the business. So if you're a brick and mortar company and you make widgets, they want to know the earnings that comes from that. And if you have unrealized gains and losses from financial instruments, they don't want that in the P&L. But if you're a financial institution, especially, you know, go to the extreme of like a pure investment bank. People who follow those entities have a view that they want everything at fair value because that's how the business is run. That's where the value is derived.
I totally get that, but then there are firms in between.
Right, there's people in between, yeah.
And for those of us that are in between, the rules that they're proposing and that are in existence now... are certainly not ideal.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that you wanted to cover?
No, I said all I want to hear.
Okay.
If you have any questions in the future, if you have any specific issues, I'm happy to talk to you. It's a pleasure talking to you because I can tell you've got some real knowledge of this, and so it makes it just a dramatically easier conversation.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm gonna turn the recorder off, but I do want to talk to you for just a minute after I do that. So just hang on. Okay. Thanks so much.